DW Deutsche Welle. Spectrum.
Hello and welcome to Spectrum on DW, deep and dirty in the worlds of science and technology. I'm Zulfikar Abani, and coming up, the European Commissioner for Research and Science tells us why traditional publishers of scientific research are just going to have to accept open access.
This is just but another challenge that they have to face, and that they, I think, see that this is going to happen. It's happening all over the world. It's happening to the east of us and to the west of us, and this is something they're just going to have to cope with.
More from EU Commissioner Marie Geoghegan-Quinn in a moment. Also on the programme, your freedoms on the net are under threat. And the Smart Seniors Project in Berlin sees senior citizens go all sci-fi. That's right here on Spectrum. But first, not a week seems to go by without there being something new happening up in space. The past few days, for instance, alone, they've seen the start of the world's fastest radio telescope starting up in Australia. A total plus for astronomers and our understanding of the universe. And just over the weekend, an unmanned, private-owned rocket and cargo capsule took off from Cape Canaveral in the US on a journey to the International Space Station. Well, our ambitions in space seem to grow every day, and it's bringing manned flights to distant planets ever closer to reality. What that means, though, is that we'll have to be able to do a lot more in space of what we can do down here on Earth, such as certain medical procedures. Well, a team of biomedical engineers from Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh and the University of Louisville are developing surgical tools that could be used for future expeditionary space flights to the moon, an asteroid, for instance, or even Mars. Their aqueous immersion surgical system is a watertight surgery system that can isolate wounds and control bleeding by creating a pressurized environment. And they've just tested it on zero-gravity flights over Texas. Laura Posmer has the details.
The makers of Star Trek were way ahead of their time. The cabin crew of the famous science fiction TV show consisted of a captain, a scientific officer, an engineer, and a medical officer. Now, as increasingly our ambitions in space include manned trips to asteroids and Mars, we may have to take a leaf out of Star Trek's book. And at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, two biomedical engineers and a medical surgeon are developing just the surgical tools that could be used on a mission. They are developing a watertight surgery system that can isolate wounds and control bleeding by creating a pressurized aqueous environment within the surgical field. The dome-shaped structure, the aqueous immersion surgical system, can be mounted over the surgical area to prevent contamination of a spacecraft cabin during surgeries, which could include working on broken limbs or traumatic injuries. James Burgess is a medical surgeon and one of the team. He says that while astronauts are usually in good physical condition and in good health, it is exactly this that puts them at risk.
The healthiest and most physically fit people are the ones that get injured. I mean, they're the ones that take the chances, they're the ones that are involved in the traumas, they're the ones that have the rib fractures, the head fractures, the spleen injuries and all that. Those are the people that are going to go.
Jennifer Hayden, a PhD student in biomedical engineering, is also on the team. She says the risks are greatest when astronauts move large, heavy equipment.
Although there is no gravity, so it would appear that the equipment itself is weightless, it still has high mass. So it's able to generate significant forces, and once that piece of equipment has started moving, it's going to be difficult to stop it.
If an accident happens, the most important factor is blood. In a zero-gravity environment, blood can flow through the cabin and contaminate other crew members. Also, the loss of blood needs to be limited as much as possible, since blood transfusions are practically impossible in space. In their small, messy laboratory, the research team demonstrates what tools they have developed to stop bleeding.
So it's a hermetically sealed or watertight cylindrical chamber that is large enough to completely enclose an organ. In this case, we'll be using ex vivo or pig hearts. There are several ports on the chamber to introduce surgical instruments so that you can perform surgery. There's also a watertight port that will allow you to introduce suction so you can remove any of the fluid that has been mixed with blood and therefore is too opaque to see through. There are also ports in there that will allow you to pump in fresh, clear fluid to replace any of the fluid that's lost in the chamber and therefore maintain the overall pressure inside the chamber.
Let me just use this to demonstrate. This chamber can be opened. Imagine this is a pig heart. This isn't quite the way it's going to look, but it's something. And it's going to be lying inside of there. So that's the pig heart. It's in there. It's full of fluid. We've locked this down. And you see those little vessels on the
on the pig heart right there, we would cut one.
Since it's a heart, only a heart, we'll be pumping a colored fluid through it. And then we should see that colored fluid begin to come out. Then. So the next step would be to increase the fluid pressure inside this. And while we're videotaping that, we'll be able to see that stop.
Conducting an experiment like this in a lab is one thing. But to make sure it will work in space, it needs to be tested at zero gravity. And the research team have done that on a special zero-gravity aircraft provided by NASA at the Johnson Space Center near Ellington Field in Houston, Texas.
Interestingly, and I didn't realize this when we began, is that they're going to give us zero-gravity experiences, but they can also give us lunar gravity experiences and Martian gravity experiences on these flights. So we will be able to take advantage of that. We'll have the opportunity to do our experiments in those altered gravitational states. We'd love to be able to appreciate a difference between them.
The next step after the zero-gravity flights will be a live surgical procedure on a rat. But more experiments require more money. Professor of Biomedical Engineering James Antaki, who has been working on the surgical tools for almost 4 years, is aware that success now will determine whether they can proceed.
Positive results from this experiment will allow us to write a grant to conduct more experiments. And welcome to the life of academia. We live from one grant to the next. So that's our short-term goal, is to prepare for the live animal experiment, which is going to be really much more, you know, definitive and conclusive.
The U.S. President Barack Obama wants astronauts to travel to an asteroid by 2025 and Mars by sometime in the 2030s. That doesn't mean that the surgical tools being developed at Carnegie Mellon will go unused until then. They could be used in regular hospitals or on military battlefields. But the goal is to have a medical officer on board future spaceflights, an officer who is equipped with the appropriate tools to perform surgery if necessary. And when that happens, the science fiction of Star Trek will be science fiction no more. This is Laura Postma for DW in Pittsburgh.
Well, that really makes Star Trek sound old school, doesn't it? Crackly line there. Okay, on to other things now. And you may recall back in June, we heard the first of the academic spring, a revolution in the sciences that started to see researchers threaten to boycott the traditional publishers of academic journals. Why? Because they're increasingly seen as too expensive and as restricting the free access to information about new medical research and innovation that could help people like you and me, if only we could just get our hands on the stuff. A month later, in July, the European Commission for Research, Innovation and Science launched its Open Access Initiative, a drive to get the traditional publishers of science journals to change their ways. The idea is for all European research that's funded with money from an 87 billion euro pot of cash called Horizon 2020 to be bound by two basic publishing standards. Gold access, gold open access, would provide immediate public access to new research articles, with the EU reimbursing any upfront publication fees carried by scientists. And green open access would see new articles made available within 6 to 12 months, depending on the area of research. It sounds great, doesn't it? But with profit-driven publishers like Elsevier posting profits in the hundreds of millions, it's hard to see they're wanting to give up too much. While the European Commissioner for Research, Innovation and Science, Marie Geoghegan-Quinn, says it can and will be done. She's just held talks with some of the main stakeholders and told me they know it's time to change.
What we're saying in simple terms is that we want to open up access to scientific publications and the underlying data so that in future you won't have to pay these expensive subscriptions to access the information which is generated by the public's taxes.
But you've also said that it's about giving the public access to this information because they could then get quicker benefits from the scientific research. I'm a little bit unsure about how that's going to work. How can it benefit citizens quicker if they can read the stuff quicker?
Well, I think if you look at the kind of information that has already been made available, let's take, for example, the Human Genome Project. When the results were made accessible, that leveraged $3 billion of research investment into around $500 billion in economic activity. And anything that benefits economic activity, in the end, benefits the general public. And also, if you look at all of the research that's being done in the area of active and healthy aging, in the area have Alzheimer's, for example, huge amounts of positive results are available and need to be made available to the public as a whole. So the public need to be able to make decisions that are based on good scientific information when they're looking at their own health or the health of their family or in their planning for their future. So for me, it's about making that information available, and after all, the public pays for it.
Now, you mentioned Alzheimer's there, and there is a sideline topic there because we've heard in the last couple of weeks that research into Alzheimer's is perhaps being scaled back. But I wanted to ask you about this because you've just recently spoken to some of the key stakeholders, the publishers. Who was there and what do they have to say for themselves? I mean, I can't imagine they were particularly happy about making all this stuff that is their profit base available so quickly.
Well, we had the traditional publishers were there, the open access publishers, then the open access stakeholders, and then we also had obviously the funding agencies. So you had, there was a vast array of views and ideas and background information available. And it was interesting for me because I expected the traditional publishers to be very much against what we were proposing. I think they realised that, you know, we've made this decision, we published in July our proposals. Horizon 2020 is going to be all supportive of open access.
That's the,
so they're
the
going to have to live with it. Yes,
that's the 80-odd billion annual fund, isn't it, which you want to
Which we want to get. Yes. So I think the traditional publishers, I mean, for me, the traditional publishers have gone through huge changes over the last 50 years. If one looks at a situation, they had to cope with a huge burst in the digital age. They did that and did it very successfully. And this is just but another challenge that they have to face, and that they, I think, see that they're this is going to happen. It's happening all over the world. It's happening to the east of us and to the west of us. And this is something they're just going to have to cope with.
So you're saying that really the ball is in our court, in the sense that in the reader's court, we have the power over this. Is that what you're really saying? I mean, normally it's the other way around. The commercial interests have the upper hand.
Well, I'm saying that it's going to provide an opportunity for new publishers to set up in business, which will create good quality jobs, hopefully, for graduates. And if you look at, there are two examples of that that we have already, Biomed Central, which is now part of the Springer Group, and you have the Public Library of Science, but there are many more. And I think this is a new promising segment of industry. It doesn't appear to damage the existing subscription publishers. So we also have an FP7, a Framework Programme 7 project, as you know, called PEER, and that recently has reported that there are no discernible effects, as it were, on publishers from having open access content in repositories.
But you have, as part of your strategy, included a rather big caveat, if I can put it that way. You say that you want to account for, and I quote, legitimate concerns in relation to privacy and commercial interests, and questions relating to large data volumes. It is rather a lot of room for manoeuvre, especially the commercial interests. They would want to hold on to that, wouldn't they? The traditional publishers.
I'm sure they would, but what I'm saying is that it's going to be the default position for Horizon 2020 for us. We have already done a lot on open access in the framework programme. If we look at what's happening, for example, the Howard Hughes Institute in America, the Wellcome Trust, the Research Council in Denmark, all this is a policy now that is becoming the accepted policy in very many of our member states and in very many with very many other funding agencies around the world. So this is a challenge that's out there. It's a challenge that's not going to go away. It's an area where it's going to grow. I think scientists are aware of the potential of this for a long time. They weren't aware probably for a long time, but they are now, and they're actively, as you said, calling for it. So, 34,000 authors in 2002 signed a letter calling on the publishers to make the material freely available. And in June, just this year, 25,000 people signed this petition to the United States White House calling for federal government policy. So there is a push now. Scientists are getting together. You know, it's very good for any startup or small company that can't afford scientific journals. And scientific journals, as we all know, are incredibly expensive. We want to make sure that the information, the research results that the European taxpayer pays for is made available in a much cheaper fashion for the scientists and for the public as a whole.
And I suppose the Horizon 2020 Fund is going to be a rather large incentive for scientists to take European funding and therefore bind them to these regulations as you want them. And yes, I can see that giving citizens quicker access to the information has its benefits. Mm-hmm. But it is still companies, isn't it, that have to make good on that research. It's still companies that are going to control what's done with that research, aren't they?
Yeah, but companies really want to have access. Small and medium-sized enterprises are very much in the same space as very many of the academic institutions or scientific groups around the world. They're not very wealthy. They're starting off. They're trying to innovate. They're trying to get the research results and use those to make products and bring those products to the marketplace. So the cheaper they can get access to that research, the quicker that they can bring that to the marketplace, and the greater chance that there is that they can grow, they can bring competitiveness, and they can bring jobs. And in the European economy at the moment, we're crying out for competitiveness and we're looking for more jobs. So anything that can help to provide the information that enables small and medium-sized enterprises to develop those research results and bring them to the marketplace, I think is a very, very good thing.
So this idea of open access to information is not just a utopian idea, sort of a hangover from the days when everything was free on the internet. It's a reality and is enforceable.
It's a reality and it's enforceable, and that's why I think it's important that we bring as many of the groups, if not all of the groups, with us as we go along this road. And the meeting that I had this week was sort of the start of a discussion with me, with these groups, a discussion which is going to continue. But I think none of them left the room without realising that we're really serious about this. This is the default position for Horizon 2020, and we're going to have to find a way to work within that.
Marie Geoghegan-Quinn, EU Commissioner for Research, Innovation and Science, on the line there from Brussels. And you're listening to Spectrum with me, Zulfikar Abani, on DW. Online, we're at dw.de/spectrum. And make sure to check us out in this, the Nobel Prize Week. You can, of course, also follow us at DW_SciTech. Well, new research is not the only area that needs more freedom. The net does too. The internet used to instill us with a sense of freedom. Now you might not be so sure. China and Iran are no longer the only examples of internet censorship. A lot of the information that we think of as being unlimited on the web is restricted in various ways. Just think of Philippines in the past week, in fact. So much so that Vinton Cerf, one of the so-called fathers of the internet, says freedom of information and censorship is an international battle that will determine the future of the web. Jared Reed has this report by Monica Griebeler.
Back in 2002, only 4 governments were known to restrict access to the internet. 10 years on, and net activists say more than 40 governments around the world censor the web, and even democracies are in on the act. In August, the Indian government blocked web pages and social media accounts to prevent the spread of rumours amid religious tension in the country. The Vietnamese leadership regularly brings bloggers to trial, and even in Ethiopia, where less than 1% of the population has internet access, the government filters websites, blocks connections, and monitors email traffic. Wolfgang Kleinwächter, a professor of internet policy at Denmark's Aarhus University, says internet freedoms are under threat.
The greatest risk, as I see it, is that countries will try to extend their sovereignty to cover the internet. It could lead to a fragmented internet. So, in the future, we may be talking about different versions of the internet around the world.
The human rights group Reporters Without Borders says 29 internet activists have been killed so far this year and 127 are in jail. The group says these acts are in breach of a UN Human Rights Council resolution that calls on countries to allow citizens free access to the internet. Kleinwächter acknowledges the UN Council can't impose sanctions on countries that breach the resolution, but says that it could name and shame those that do. But even in democracies, there are those people who say that some censorship is good. They would support blocking access to child pornography, or for instance, things such as videos that cause offence to religious groups, often sparking riots. German Brooks heads the Global Network Initiative.
There are very, very few either ISPs, internet service providers, or countries that have no restrictions at all. And those restrictions are, of course, the result of very careful debate in democratic societies about what few areas of information are regarded as harmful and then can be censored. And child pornography is one. Extreme violence shown on the internet could be another area.
Sweden is often cited for its progressive social policies and transparency. About 90% of Swedish households have access to the internet. But even Sweden is being criticised, along with other EU countries, for storing internet user data, data preservation as it's known. In Sweden, authorities hold such data for 6 months. Sweden's deputy foreign minister is Frank Belfrage.
The Swedish system is equally bad as a system in a non-democratic country. I would argue against that. Those regimes which use the internet to monitor and the individual and look after that, because what they're after is to protect a non-democratic society. And there, of course, we are at a total clash in terms of opinion.
Internet activists are also concerned about increased online surveillance. In particular, they're concerned about technologies developed in the West that enable internet-based espionage, and they're calling on governments to restrict the trade. Here's Eric King of Private International, which is a non-government organisation that monitors the export of surveillance technology.
Western countries are not limiting that trade. They're not putting any restrictions on what technology can go where. And this is a huge problem because mass surveillance technology, mass censorship technologies are being exported to repressive regimes where they're used to for political control.
But there is some good news. In China, a country well known for its great firewall, which blocks many websites including Facebook and Twitter, internet users there have found ways to get around censorship. They've long used proxy servers and encoded networks such as the Tor network, which allow users to remain anonymous on the web. Here's German Brooks of the Global Network Initiative again.
If you look at China, it's said that up to 10% of internet users find ways of accessing what they want anyway. Is this going to change China? Well, not immediately. It's not going to change Cambodia or Vietnam immediately. But over time, particularly if one can show these countries model laws and explain why those model laws, ultimately, particularly for the smaller countries, will be to their economic advantage, then I think we have opportunities to move in the right direction.
Jeremy Brooks of the Global Network Initiative there, and Jared Reed had that report there by Monica Griebeler.
Digital Europe, bringing the continent's tech scene to your ears.
The UN estimates that there'll be over 1 billion people over the age of 60 in 10 years' time. Alone in Germany, a third of the population will be over the age of 60 by 2035. It's what's known as the ageing society, if you haven't heard of it before. It's considered a growing problem for governments, but it's also seen as a growing opportunity for technology businesses. And it's inspired 28 research organisations, companies and healthcare providers to start the Smart Senior Initiative. They've come up with all manner of new health gadgets and have just concluded a 3-month trial in Potsdam near Berlin, where apartments were equipped with sensors, high-speed internet and a data hub known as the Ambient Assisted Living Home Gateway. In Berlin, Cinema Nippard reports.
How many times have you heard that the over 60s have trouble with the internet and that they need constant help with new technologies? Well, the Smart Senior Research Project wants to change that. It's all about getting senior citizens comfortable with new technology so it can help them as they age. Take, for instance, a motion sensor watch. If a person wearing the watch hasn't moved for a period of time, the system will pick up on that and send a message to emergency services. Daniel Resnick is with Siemens Corporate Technology.
This is Wi-Fi-based watch with accelerometer sensors, monitoring of the motion of the patient. And, you also have the possibility to deliver short textual messages to the senior, and by pressing those two buttons, the senior may ask for assistance.
Siemens has also worked with BMW and Germany's Global Healthcare on a sensor vest which monitors vital signs when a person is driving, and it could save them if they have a stroke or a heart attack. Here's Mama Dubinsky from Global Healthcare.
There's emergency. The car takes over control of the situation. The driver has no hands on the driving wheel. Radars will detect surrounding vehicles. and will find a spot where it can make the lane change, makes the lane change by itself, hands-free, slows down and will stop at the right lane and wait for the already informed rescue team.
For those with chronic medical conditions, the Smart Senior Project allows for vital signs like your blood pressure to be transmitted to a GP, and if necessary, the patient can talk to their doctor or nurse via video call from their smart TV. Dr. Mehmet Gurvetsin is from the Department of Geriatric Medicine at the Charité University Hospital in Berlin, and he's also one of the founders of the Smart Senior Project.
Our aim is not to replace a doctor or a system that works well. In this study, we detect a few patients that have very high blood pressure. You wouldn't detect them if you don't have these devices at home and measure the blood pressure. So the general practitioner can use the system to give a better health care than before.
67-year-old Klaus-Dieter Luck was part of the trial in Potsdam.
Am besten finde ich das Gesundheitsportal.
The health portal was the best. It set my personal data automatically to my doctor at a telemedical center. It's great. If my blood pressure is too high, they can give me a call and I can see the doctor. The video communication is great too. If you can get out, you can still talk to other people, and that's great.
83-year-old Sigrid Gorn also took part in the trial and wants to stay independent in her own apartment for as long as possible.
It was quite nice to be connected, for example, via video technology or video call with the medical center.
But both Gorn and Luck say there were some problems with the system. It sometimes got slow and there were other technical glitches too. Back on the plus side, Gorn says she enjoyed testing a multimedia application for physical training. Dr. Michael Jorn is with the Fraunhofer Institute, one of the developers.
We focused on two medical indications. The first one is fall prevention. So you have to stabilize your balance. And the other medical application is stroke rehabilitation. And that was the idea to train the arm muscles after a stroke.
It uses a smart TV screen. A male avatar demonstrates the exercises, which include standing on one leg. The program is interactive and tells the user if they're doing the exercise correctly.
We use the Kinect sensor from Microsoft, and we developed the motion sensor. We integrate and interpret this data, and then we give feedback to the senior.
The Smart Senior system is modular, which means you can choose the parts you want. The current setup will set you back several thousand euros, but Mehmet Gurvetsin from the Charité expects the price will come down as demand increases, the technology becomes cheaper to produce, or it gets subsidized.
In the future, we want some part of the system to be paid by, for example, insurance companies or other healthcare parties that see a real advantage in the system. For example, the advantage of a home care for home-based rehabilitation.
Michael Balash, project coordinator of the Smart Senior Consortium and senior researcher at Telecom Innovation Laboratories in Berlin, says that in addition to helping senior citizens live more independently, the project has helped bring technology and medicine closer together.
It was also very, very interesting to see how technical people learn from the medical people what really the people do need, the seniors do need. And on the other side, the medical people could learn from the technical people what techniques and modern intelligent systems can offer. And these working together brought a lot of great ideas.
But this was just the first of more trials to come. Cinema Nippard, DW, Berlin.
Well, that's just about all from Spectrum on DW for now. Don't forget, you can always keep up with our stuff at dw.de/science. Listen again or download the podcast at dw.de/spectrum. I'm Zulfikar Abani. The studio tech was Melanie Schlicht. Next week, the Rio Gun Detector. Hope you can make it then. Thanks for listening and bye for now.
Oh.